more guffaws from the others. Sir Alastair stood up, his mouth a tight line. "Come and make your japes with steel in your end." Tyrion looked pointedly at his right hand.
"Why, I have steel in my hand, Sir Alastair, although it appears to be a crab fork. Shall we duel?"
He hopped up in his chair and began poking at Thorne's chest with a tiny fork. Roars of laughter filled the tower room. Bits of crab flew from the Lord Commander's mouth as he began to gasp and choke. Even his raven joined in, cawing loudly from above the window.
"Duel! Duel! Duel!"
Sir Alastair Thorne walked from the room so stiffly it looked as if he had a dagger up his butt. Mormont was still gasping for breath. Tyrion pounded him on the back. "To the victor goes the spoils," he called out. "I claim Thorne's share of the crabs." Finally, the Lord Commander recovered himself.
"You are a wicked man to provoke us, Sir Alastair, so," he scolded.
Tyrion seated himself and took a sip of wine.
"If a man paints a target on his chest, he should expect that sooner or later someone will loose an arrow at him. I've seen dead men with more humour than your Sir Alastair."
"Not so," objected the Lord Steward, Bowen Marsh, a man as round and red as a pomegranate. "You ought to hear the droll names he gives the lads he trains." Tyrion had heard a few of those droll names.
"I'll wager the lads have a few names for him as well," he said. "Chip the ice off your eyes, my good lords. Sir Alastair Thorne should be mucking out your stables, not drilling your young warriors."
"The watch has no shortage of stable boys," Lord Mormont grumbled. "That seems to be all they send us these days, stable boys and sneak thieves and rapers. Sir Alastair's an anointed knight. One of the few to take the black since I've been Lord Commander. He fought bravely at King's Landing."
On the wrong side, Sir Jeremy Ryker commented dryly. "I ought to know. I was there, on the battlements beside him. Tywin Lannister gave us a splendid choice. Take the black, or see our heads on spikes before evenfall. No offence intended, Tyrion."
"Oh, none taken, Sir Jeremy. My father is very fond of spiked heads, especially those of people who have annoyed him in some fashion. And a face as noble as yours, well, no doubt he saw you decorating the city wall above the King's Gate. I think you would have looked very striking up there."
"Thank you,"
Sir Jeremy replied with a sardonic smile. Lord Commander Mormont cleared his throat.
"Sometimes I fear Sir Alastair saw you true, Tyrion. You do mock us, and our noble purpose here."
Tyrion shrugged.
"We all need to be mocked from time to time, Lord Mormont, lest we start to take ourselves too seriously. More wine, please." He held out his cup.
As Ryker filled it for him, Bowen Marsh said,
"You have a great thirst for a small man."
"Oh, I think Lord Tyrion is quite a large man,"
Maester Aemon said from the far end of the table. He spoke softly, yet the high officers of the Night's Watch all fell silent, the better to hear what the ancient had to say.
"I think he is a giant come among us here at the end of the world."
Tyrion answered gently,
"I've been called many things, my lord, but giant is seldom one of them." "Nonetheless," Maester Aemon said, as his clouded, milk-white eyes moved to Tyrion's face, "I think it is true."
For once Tyrion Lannister found himself at a loss for words. He could only bow his head politely and say,
"You are too kind, Maester Aemon."
The blind man smiled. He was a tiny thing, wrinkled and hairless, shrunken beneath the weight of 100 years, so his maester's collar, with its links of many metals, hung loose about his throat.
"I have been called many things, my lord," he said, "but kind is seldom one of them."
This time Tyrion himself led the laughter. Much later, when the serious business of eating was done and the others had left, Mormont offered Tyrion a chair beside the fire and a cup of mulled spirits so strong they brought tears to his eyes.
"King's Road can be perilous this far north," the Lord Commander told him as they drank.
"I have Jick and Morik," Tyrion said, "and Yoren is riding south again."
"Yoren is only one man. The watch shall escort you as far as Winterfell," Mormont announced in a tone that brooked no argument. "Three men should be sufficient."
"Well, if you insist, my lord," Tyrion said, "you might send young Snow. He would be glad for a chance to see his brothers."
Mormont frowned through his thick grey beard. "Snow, the Stark bastard. I think not. The young ones need to forget the lives they left behind, the brothers and mothers and all that. A visit home would only stir up feelings best left alone. I know these things. My own blood kin. My sister Mage rules Bear Island now. Since my son's dishonor. Type nieces I've never seen." He took a swallow. "Besides, John Snow is only a boy. You shall have three strong swords to keep you safe."
"I'm touched by your concern, Lord Mormont." The strong drink was making Tyrion light-headed, but not so drunk that he did not realize that the old bear wanted something from him. "I hope I can repay your kindness."
"Oh, you can," Mormont said bluntly. "Your sister sits beside the king. Your brother is a great knight, and your father the most powerful lord in the Seven Kingdoms. Speak to them for us. Tell them of our need here. You have seen for yourself, my lord, the night's watch is dying. Our strength is less than 1,000 now. 600 here, 200 in the Shadow Tower, even fewer at East Watch, and a scant third of those fighting men. The wall is 100 leagues long. Think of that. Should an attack come, I have three men to defend each mile of wall."
"Three and a third," Tyrion said with a yawn. Mormont scarcely seemed to hear him. The old man warmed his hands before the fire.
"I sent Benjen Stark to search after Yon Royce's son, lost on his first ranging. Royce boy was green as summer grass, yet he insisted on the honour of his own command, saying it was his due as a knight. I did not wish to offend his lord father, so I yielded. I sent him out with two men I deemed as good as any in the watch. More fool I."
"Fool,"
the raven agreed. Tyrion glanced up. The bird peered down at him with those beady black eyes, ruffling its wings.
"Fool,"
it called again. Doubtless El Mormont would take it amiss if he throttled the creature. A pity. The Lord Commander took no notice of the irritating bird.
"Garrett was near as old as I am, and longer on the wall," he went on. "Yet it would seem he forswore himself and fled. I should never have believed it, not of him, but Lord Eddard sent me his head from Winterfell. Of Royce there's no word. One deserter and two men lost, and now Ben Stark, too, has gone missing." He sighed deeply. "Who am I to send searching after him? In 2 years I will be 70, too old and too weary for the burden I bear. Yet if I set it down, who will pick it up? Alistair Thorne? Bowen Marsh? I would have to be as blind as Maester Aemon not to see what they are. The Night's Watch has become an army of sullen boys and tired old men. Apart from the men at my table tonight, I have perhaps 20 who can read, and even fewer who can think or plan or lead. Once the watch spent its summers building, and each Lord Commander raised the wall higher than he found it. That's all we can do to stay alive."
He was in deadly earnest, Tyrion realized. He felt faintly embarrassed for the old man. Lord Mormont had spent a good part of his life on the wall, and he needed to believe if all those years would have any meaning. "I promise the king will hear of your need," Tyrion said gravely, "and I will speak to my father and my brother Jaime as well." And he would. Tyrion Lannister was as good as his word. He left the rest unsaid. That King Robert would ignore him, Lord Tywin would ask if he had taken leave of his senses, and Jaime would only laugh.
"You are a young man, Tyrion," Mormont said. "How many winters have you seen?"
He shrugged. 8, 9, I misremember.
"And all of them short?"
"As you say, my lord." He had been born in the dead of winter, a terrible, cruel one that the mace has said had lasted near 3 years. But Tyrion's earliest memories were of spring.
"When I was a boy, it was said that a long summer always meant a long winter to come. This summer has lasted 9 years, Tyrion, and a tenth will soon be upon us. Think on that."
"When I was a boy," Tyrion replied, "my wet nurse told me that one day, if men were good, the gods would give the world a summer without ending. Perhaps we've been better than we thought, and the great summer is finally at hand," he grinned.
The Lord Commander did not seem amused. "You are not fool enough to believe that, my lord. Already the days grow shorter. There can be no mistake. Aemon has had letters from the Citadel, findings in accord with his own. The end of summer stares us in the face."
Mormont reached out and clutched Tyrion tightly by the hand.
"You must make them understand, I tell you, my lord. The darkness is coming. There are wild things in the woods, direwolves and mammoths, and snow bears the size of aurochs, and I've seen darker shapes in my dreams."
"In your dreams?" Tyrion echoed, thinking how badly he needed another strong drink.
Mormont was deaf to the edge in his voice.
"The fisherfolk near Eastwatch have glimpsed white walkers on the shore."
This time Tyrion could not hold his tongue.
"The fisherfolk in Lannisport often glimpse merlings."
"Denis Malister writes that the mountain people are moving south, slipping past the Shadow Tower in numbers greater than ever before. They are running, my lord. But running from what?"
Lord Mormont moved to the window and stared out into the night.
"These are old bones, Lannister, but they have never felt a chill like this. Tell the king what I say, I pray you. Winter is coming, and when the long night falls, only the night's watch will stand between the realm and the darkness that sweeps from the north. The gods help us all, if we are not ready."
"The gods help me if I do not get some sleep tonight. Yaren is determined to ride at first light."
Tyrion got to his feet, sleepy from wine and tired of doom.
"I thank you for all the courtesies you have done me, Lord Mormont."
"Tell them, Tyrion. Tell them, and make them believe. That is all the thanks I need."
He whistled, and his raven flew to him and perched on his shoulder. Mormont smiled and gave the bird some corn from his pocket. And that was how Tyrion left him. It was bitter cold outside. Bundled thickly in his furs, Tyrion Lannister pulled on his gloves and nodded to the poor frozen wretches standing sentry outside the commander's keep. He set off across the yard for his own chambers in the King's Tower, walking as briskly as his legs could manage. Patches of snow crunched beneath his feet as his boots broke the night's crust, and his breath steamed before him like a banner. He shoved his hands into his armpits and walked faster, praying that Morrek had remembered to warm his bed with hot bricks from the fire. Behind the King's Tower, the wall glimmered in the light of the moon, immense and mysterious. Tyrion stopped for a moment to look up at it. His legs ached of cold and haste. Suddenly, a strange madness took hold of him, a yearning to look once more off the end of the world. It would be his last chance, he thought. Tomorrow he would ride south, and he could not imagine why he would ever want to return to this frozen desolation. The King's Tower was before him, with its promise of warmth and a soft bed, yet Tyrion found himself walking past it towards the vast pale palisade of the wall. A wooden stair ascended the south face, anchored on huge, rough-hewn beams sunk deep into the ice and frozen in place. Back and forth it switched, clawing its way upward, as crooked as a bolt of lightning. The Black Brothers assured him that it was much stronger than it looked. But Tyrion's legs were cramping too badly for him to even contemplate the ascent. He went instead to an iron cage beside the well, clambered inside, and yanked hard on the bell rope 3 quick pulls. He had to wait what seemed an eternity, standing there inside the bars with a wall to his back, long enough for Tyrion to begin to wonder why he was doing this. He had just about decided to forget his sudden whim and go to bed when the cage gave a jerk and began to ascend. He moved upward slowly, by fits and starts at first, then more smoothly. The ground fell away beneath him. The cage swung, and Tyrion wrapped his hands around the iron bars. He could feel the cold of the metal even through his gloves. Morrick had a fire burning in his room, he noted with approval, but the Lord Commander's tower was dark. The old bear had more sense than he did, it seemed. Then he was above the towers, still inching his way upward. Castle Black lay below him, etched in moonlight. You could see how stark and empty it was from up here. Windowless keeps, crumbling walls, courtyards choked with broken stone. Farther off he could see the lights of Molestown, the little village half a league south along the King's Road, and here and there the bright glitter of moonlight on water where icy streams descended from the mountain heights to cut across the plains. The rest of the world was a bleak emptiness of windswept hills and rocky fields spotted with snow. Finally, a thick voice behind him said, "Seven Elves, it's the dwarf!" And the cage jerked to a sudden stop and hung there, swinging slowly back and forth, the ropes creaking. "Bring him in, damn it!" There was a grunt and a loud groaning of wood as the cage slid sideways, and then the wall was beneath him. Tyrion waited until the swinging had stopped before he pushed open the cage door and hopped down onto the ice. A heavy figure in black was leaning on the winch, while a second held the cage with a gloved hand. Their faces were muffled in woolen scarves, so only their eyes showed, and they were plump with layers of wool and leather, black on black. "And what will you be wanting this time of night?" the one by the winch said. "A last look." The men exchanged sour glances. "Look all you want," the other one said. "Just take a care you don't fall off, little man. The old bear would have our hides." A small wooden shack stood under the great crane, and Tyrion saw the dull glow of a brazier and felt a brief gust of warmth when the winchmen opened the door and went back inside. And then he was alone. It was bitingly cold up here, and the wind pulled at his clothes like an insistent lover. The top of the wall was wider than the King's Road often was, so Tyrion had no fear of falling, although the footing was slicker than he would have liked. The brothers spread crushed stone across the walkways, but the weight of countless footsteps would melt the wall beneath, so the ice would seem to grow around the gravel, swallowing it, until the path was bare again and it was time to crush more stone. Still, it was nothing that Tyrion could not manage. He looked off to the east and west, at the wall stretching before him a vast white road with no beginning and no end, and a dark abyss on either side. West, he decided, for no special reason, and he began to walk that way, following the pathway nearest the north edge, where the gravel looked freshest. His bare cheeks were ruddy with the cold, and his legs complained more loudly with every step, but Tyrion ignored them. The wind swirled around him, gravel crunched beneath his boots, while ahead the white ribbon followed the lines of the hills, rising higher and higher until it was lost beyond the western horizon. He passed a massive catapult, as tall as a city wall, its base sunk deep into the wall. The throwing arm had been taken off for repairs and then forgotten. It lay there, like a broken toy, half embedded in the ice. On the far side of the catapult, A muffled voice called out a challenge. "Who goes there?" "Halt!" Tyrion stopped.
"If I halt too long, I'll freeze in place, John," he said as a shaggy pale shape slid toward him silently and sniffed at his furs. "Hello, ghost."
Jon Snow moved closer. He looked bigger and heavier in his layers of fur and leather, the hood of his cloak pulled down over his face.
"Lannister," he said, yanking loose the scarf to uncover his mouth. "This is the last place I would have expected to see you." He carried a heavy spear tipped in iron, taller than he was, and a sword hung at his side in a leather sheath. Across his chest was a gleaming black war horn banded with silver.
"This is the last place I would have expected to be seen," Tyrion admitted. "I was captured by a whim. If I touch ghost, will he chew my hand off?"
"Not with me here," John promised. Tyrion scratched the white wolf behind the ears. The red eyes watched him impassively. The beast came up as high as his chest now. Another year, and Tyrion had the gloomy feeling he'd be looking up at him.
"What are you doing here tonight?" he asked. "Besides freezing your manhood off?"
"I have drawn night guard," John said. "Again. Sir Alistair has kindly arranged for the watch commander to take a special interest in me. He seems to think that if they keep me awake half the night, I'll fall asleep during morning drill. So far, I have disappointed him."
Tyrion grinned.
"And has Ghost learned to juggle yet?"
"No," said John, smiling. "But Gren held his own against Halder this morning, and Pip is no longer dropping his sword quite so often as he did."
"Pip?"
"Pippa is his real name, the small boy with the large ears. He saw me working with Gren and asked for help. Thorn had never even shown him the proper way to grip a sword." He turned to look north. "I have a mile of wall to guard. Will you walk with me?"
"If you walk slowly," Tyrion said.
"The watch commander tells me I must walk to keep my blood from freezing, but he never said how fast." They walked, with Ghost pacing along beside John like a white shadow.
"I leave on the morrow," Tyrion said.
"I know." John sounded strangely sad.
"I plan to stop at Winterfell on their way south if there's any message that you would like me to deliver."
"Tell Rob that I am going to command the night's watch and keep him safe. So he might as well take up needlework with the girls and have Micken melt down his sword for horseshoes."
"Your brother is bigger than me," Tyrion said with a laugh. "I decline to deliver any message that might get me killed.
Rickon will ask when I'm coming home. Try to explain where I've gone if you can. Tell him he can have all my things while I'm away. He'll like that."
People seem to be asking a great deal of him today, Tyrion Lannister thought.
"You could put all this in a letter, you know."
"Rickon can't read yet. Bran..."
He stopped suddenly. "I don't know what message to send Bran. Help him, Tyrion."
"What help could I give him? I'm no maester to ease his pain. I have no spells to give him back his legs."
"You gave me help when I needed it," Jon Snow said.
"I gave you nothing,"
Tyrion said. "Words." "Then give your words to Bran, too."
"You're asking a lame man to teach a cripple how to dance," Tyrion said. "However sincere the lesson, the result is likely to be grotesque."
"Still, I know what it is to love a brother, Lord Snow. I will give Bran whatever small help is in my power." "Thank you, my Lord of Lannister." He pulled off his glove and offered his bare hand. "Friend?" Tyrion found himself oddly touched.
"Most of my kin are bastards," he said with a wry smile. "But you're the first I've had to friend."
He pulled a glove off with his teeth and clasped Snow by the hand, flesh against flesh. The boy's grip was firm and strong. When he had donned his glove again, Jon Snow turned abruptly and walked to the low, icy northern parapet. Beyond him the wall fell away sharply. Beyond him there was only the darkness and the wild. Tyrion followed him, and side by side they stood upon the edge of the world. The Night's Watch permitted the forest to come no closer than half a mile of the north face of the wall. The thickets of ironwood and sentinel and oak that had once grown there had been harvested centuries ago to create a broad swathe of open ground through which no enemy could hope to pass unseen. Tyrion had heard that elsewhere along the wall, between the three fortresses, the wildwood had come creeping back over the decades, that there were places where grey-green sentinels and pale-white weirwoods had taken root in the shadows of the wall itself. But Castle Black had a prodigious appetite for firewood, and here the forest was still kept at bay by the axes of the Black Brothers. It was never far, though. From up here Tyrion could see it, the dark trees looming beyond the stretch of open ground, like a second wall built parallel to the first, a wall of night. Few axes had ever swung in that black wood, what even the moonlight could not penetrate the ancient tangle of root and thorn and grasping limb. Out there the trees grew huge, and the ranger said they seemed to brood and knew not men. It was small wonder the Night's Watch named it the Haunted Forest. As he stood there and looked at all that darkness with no fires burning anywhere, with the wind blowing and the cold like a spear in his guts, Tyrion Lannister felt as though he could almost believe the talk of the others, the enemy and the night. His jokes of grumpkins and snarks no longer seemed quite so droll. "My uncle is out there," Snow said softly, leaning on his spear as he stared off into the darkness. "The first night they sent me up here, I thought Uncle Benjen will ride back tonight, and I'll see him first and blow the horn. He never came, though. Not that night, nor any night."
"We'll give him time," Tyrion said.
Far off to the north, a wolf began to howl. Another voice picked up the call, then another. Ghost cocked his head and listened. "If he doesn't come back," Jon Snow promised, "Ghost and I will go find him." He put his hand on the direwolf's head.
"I believe you," Tyrion said.
But what he thought was,
"And who will go find you?" He shivered.
Arya. The small square keep was half a ruin, and so too the great grey knight who lived there. He was so old he did not understand their questions. No matter what was said to him, he would only smile and mutter,
"I held the bridge against Sir Maenor. Red hair and black temper he had, but he could not move me. 6 wounds I took before I killed him. 6.
The maester who cared for him was a young man, thankfully. After the old knight had drifted to sleep in his chair, he took them aside and said, "I fear you seek a ghost. We had a bird, ages ago, half a year at least. The Lannisters caught Lord Beric near the God's Eye. He was hanged." "Aye, hanged he was, but Thoris cut him down before he died." Lem's broken nose was not so red or swollen as it had been, but it was healing crooked, giving his face a lopsided look. "His lordship's a hard man to kill, he is." "An hard man to find, it would seem," the maester said. "Have you asked the Lady of the Leaves?"
"We shall," said Greenbeard.
The next morning, as they crossed the little stone bridge behind the keep, Gendry wondered if this was the bridge the old man had fought over. No one knew.
"Most like it is," said Jack Belocchi. "Don't see no other bridges."
"You'd know for certain if there was a song," said Tom Sevenstrings. "One good song, and we'd know who Sir Maynard used to be and why he wanted to cross this bridge so bad. Poor old Leicester might be as far famed as a dragon knight if he'd only had sense enough to keep a singer.
"'Lord Leicester's sons died in Robert's rebellion,' grumbled Lem. "'Some on one side, some on t'other. "'He's not been right in the head since. "'No bloody songs like to help any of that.'
"'What did the maester mean about asking the lady of the leaves?' "'Ari asked Angai as they rode. "'The archer smiled. "'Wait and see.' 3 days later, as they rode through a yellow wood, Jack be lucky, unslung his horn and blew a signal, a different one than before. The sound had scarcely died away when rope ladders unrolled from the limbs of trees.
"'Up are the horses, and up we go,' said Tom, half singing the words.
They climbed to a hidden village in the upper branches. A maze of rope walkways and little moss-covered houses concealed behind walls of red and gold, and were taken to the Lady of the Leaves, a stick-thin, white-haired woman dressed in rough spun.
"'We cannot stay here much longer with autumn on us,' she told them. "'A dozen wolves went down the Hayford Road 9 days past, hunting. If they chanced to look up, they might have seen us.'
"'You've not seen Lord Berwick?' asked Tom Sevenstrings.
"'He's dead,'
the woman sounded sick.
"'The mountain caught him and drove a dagger through his eye. "'A begging brother told us he had it from the lips of a man who saw it happen.'
"'That's an old stale tale, and false,' said Lem. "'The Lightning Lord's not so easy to kill. "'Sir Gregor might have put his eye out, but a man don't die of that. "'Jack could tell you.'
"'Well, I never did,' said one-eyed Jack Belucky. "'My father got himself good and hanged by Lord Piper's bailiff. "'My brother Wat got sent to the wall, "'and the Lannisters killed my other brothers. "'And I, that's nothing.'
"'You swear he's not dead?'
the woman clutched Lem's arm.
"'Bless you, Lem, that's the best tiding we've had in half a year. "'May the warrior defend him, and the Red Priest too.'
The next night they found shelter beneath the scorched shell of a sept in a burned village called Sally Dance. Only shards remained of its windows of leaded glass, and the aged septon who greeted them said the looters had even made off with the mother's costly robes, the crone's gilded lantern, and the silver crown the father had worn.
"'They hacked the maiden's breasts off too, though those were only wood,' he told them. "'And the eyes were jet and lapis and mother of pearl. "'They pried them out with their knives. "'May the mother have mercy on them all.'
"'Whose work was this?' said Lem Lemoncloak. "'Mummers?'
"'No,' the old man said. "'Northmen they were, savages who worshipped trees. "'They wanted the Kingslayer, they said.'
"'Aria heard him and chewed her lip. "'She could feel Gendry looking at her.' It made her angry and ashamed. There were a dozen men living in the vault beneath the sept, amongst cobwebs and roots and broken wine casks, but they had no word of Beric Dondarrion either. Not even their leader, who wore soot-blackened armour and a crude lightning bolt on his cloak. When Greenbeard saw Arya staring at him, he laughed and said, "'The Lightning Lord is everywhere and nowhere, skinny squirrel.' "'I'm not a squirrel,' she said. "'I'll almost be a woman soon. I'll be 1 in 10.'
"'Best watch out I don't marry you, then.'
He tried to tickle her under the chin, but Arya slapped his stupid hand away. Lem and Gendry played tiles with their hosts that night, while Tom Sevenstrings sang a silly song about Big Belly Ben and the High Septon's Goose. Angai let Arya try his longbow, but no matter how hard she bit her lip, she could not draw it. "'You need a lighter bow, m'lady,' the freckled bowman said. "'If there's season wood at River Run, might be I'll make you one.' Tom overheard him and broke off his song. "'You're a young fool, Archer. If we go to River Run, it will only be to collect a ransom. Won't be no time for you to sit about making bows. Be thankful if you get out with your hide. Lord Huster was hanging outlaws before you were shaving, and that son of his... Oh, "'A man who hates music can't be trusted, I always say.'
"'It's not music he hates,' says Lem. "'It's you, fool.'
"'Well, he has no cause. "'The wench was willing to make a man of him. "'Is it my fault he drank too much to do the deed?' "'Lem snorted through his broken nose. Was it you who made a song of it, or some other bloody ass in love with his own voice?
I only sang it the once, Tom complained, and who's to say the song was about him? 'Twas a song about a fish.
A floppy fish, said Angai, laughing. Arya didn't care what Tom's stupid songs were about. She turned to Harwin.
What did he mean about ransom?
We have sore need of horses, m'lady. Armour as well. Sword, shield, spears. All things coin can buy. Aye, and seed for planting. Winter is coming, remember?
He touched her under the chin.
You will not be the first high-born captive we've ransomed, nor the last, I'd hope.
That much was true, Arya knew. Knights were captured and ransomed all the time, and sometimes women were too.
But what if Rob won't pay their price?
She wasn't a famous knight, and kings were supposed to put the realm before their sisters. And her lady mother, what would she say? Would she still want her back, after all the things she'd done? Arya chewed her lip and wondered. The next day they rode to a place called High Heart, a hill so lofty that from atop it Arya felt as though she could see half the world. Around its brow stood a ring of huge pale stumps, all that remained of a circle of once mighty weirwoods. Arya and Gendry walked around the hill to count them. There were 31, some so wide she could have used them for a bed. High Heart had been sacred to the children of the forest, Tom Sevenstrings told her, and some of their magic lingered here still.
No harm can ever come to those as sleep here, the singer said.
Arya thought that must be true. The hill was so high, and the surrounding land so flat, that no enemy could approach unseen.
The small folk hereabouts shunned the place, Tom told her. It was said to be haunted by the ghosts of the children of the forest who had died here when the Andal king, named Ereg the Kinslayer, had cut down their grove. Arya knew about the children of the forest, and about the Andals too, but ghosts did not frighten her. She used to hide in the crypts of Winterfell when she was little, and play games of Come Into My Castle and Monsters and Maidens amongst the stone kings on their thrones. Yet even so, the hair on the back of her neck stood up that night. She had been asleep, but the storm woke her. The wind pulled the coverlet right off her and sent it swirling into the bushes. When she went after it, she heard voices. Beside the embers of their campfire, she saw Tom, Lem, and Greenbeard talking to a tiny little woman, a foot shorter than Arya, and older than old Nan, all stooped and wrinkled, and leaning on a gnarled black cane. Her white hair was so long it came almost to the ground. When the wind gusted, it blew about her head in a fine cloud. Her flesh was whiter, the colour of milk, and it seemed to Arya that her eyes were red, though it was hard to tell from the bushes.
"The old god stir, and will not let me sleep," she heard the woman say. "I dreamt I saw a shadow with a burning heart butchering a golden stag. I dreamt of a man without a face waiting on the bridge that swayed and swung. On his shoulder perched a drowned crow with seaweed hanging from its wings. I dreamt of a roaring river and a woman that was a fish. Dead she drifted with red tears on her cheeks. But when her eyes did open, oh, I woke from terror. All this I dreamt and more. Do you have the gifts for me to pay me for my dreams?"
"Dreams?" grumbled Lem Lemonclo. "What good are dreams? Fish women and drowned crows. I'd a dream myself last night. I was kissing this tavern wench I used to know. Are you going to pay me for that, old woman?"
"The wench is dead," the woman hissed. "Only worms may kiss her now."
And then to Tom Sevenstring she said,
"I'll have my song, or I'll have you gone."
So the singer played for her, so soft and sad that Arya only heard snatches of the words, though the tune was half familiar. Sansa would know it, I bet. Her sister had known all the songs, and she could even play a little and sing so sweetly. All I could ever do was shout the words. The next morning, the little white woman was nowhere to be seen. As they saddled their horses, Arya asked Tom Sevenstrings if the children of the forest still dwelt on High Heart. The singer chuckled.
"Saw her, did ye?"
"Was she a ghost? Do ghosts complain of how their joints creak? No, she's only an old dwarf woman, a queer one, though, and evil-eyed. But she knows things she has no business knowing, and sometimes she'll tell you if she likes the look of you."
"Did she like the looks of you?"
Arya asked doubtfully. The singer laughed.
"A sound of me, at least. She always makes me sing the same bloody song, though. Not a bad song, mind you, but I know others just as good." He shook his head. "What matters is, we have the scent now. You'll soon be seeing Thoros and the Lightning Lord, I'll wager. If you're their men, why do they hide from you?"
Tom Sevenstrings rolled his eyes at that, but Harbin gave her an answer. "I wouldn't call it hiding, milady, but it's true. Lord Beric moves about a lot and seldom lets on what his plans are. That way, no one can betray him. By now, there must be hundreds of us sworn to him, maybe thousands. But it wouldn't do for us all to trail along behind him. We'd eat the country bare, or get butchered in a battle by some bigger host. The way we're scattered in little bands, we can strike in a dozen places at once, and be off somewhere else before they know. And when one of us is caught and put to the question, well, we can't tell them where to find Lord Beric, no matter what they do to us." He hesitated. "You know what it means, to be put to the question?"
Arya nodded. "Tickling, they called it, Polliver and Raff and all."
She told them about the village by the guard's eye where she and Gendry had been caught, and the questions that the tickler had asked.
"Is there gold hidden in the village?" he would always begin. "Silver, gems. Is there food? Where is Lord Beric? Which of you village folk helped him? Where did he go? How many men did he have with him? How many knights? How many bowmen? How many were horsed? How are they armed? How many wounded? Where did they go, did you say?"
Just thinking of it, she could hear the shrieks again and smell the stench of blood and shit and burning flesh. "He always asked the same questions," she told the outlaw solemnly, "but he changed the tickling every day." "No child should be made to suffer that," Harwin said when she was done. "The mountain lost half his men at the stone mill, we hear. Might be this tickler's floating down the Red Fork even now, with fish biting at his face. If not, well, it's one more crime they'll answer for. I've heard his lordship say this war began when the Hands sent him out to bring the king's justice to Gregor Clegane. And that's how he means for it to end." He gave her shoulder a reassuring pat. "You'd best mount up, milady. It's a long day's ride to Acorn Hall, but at the end of it, we'll have a roof over our heads and a hot supper in our bellies." It was a long day's ride, but as dusk was settling, they forded a brook and came up on Acorn Hall, with its stone curtain walls and great oaken keep. Its master was away fighting in the retinue of his master, Lord Vance, the castle gates closed and barred in his absence. But his lady wife was an old friend of Tom Sevenstrings, and Angai said they had once been lovers. Angai often rode beside her. He was closer to her in age than any of them, but Gendry, and he told her droll tales of the Dornish marches. He never fooled her, though. "He's not my friend. He's only staying close to watch me and make sure I don't ride off again." Well, Arya could watch as well. Sirio Forel had taught her how. Lady Smallwood welcomed the outlaws kindly enough, though she gave them a tongue-lashing for dragging a young girl through the war. She became even more wroth when Lem let slip that Arya was high-born. "Who dressed the poor child in those Bolton rags?" she demanded of them. "That badge. There's many a man who would hang her in half a heartbeat for wearing a flayed man on her breast." Arya promptly found herself marched upstairs, forced into a tub, and doused with scalding hot water. Lady Smallwood's maidservants, scrubbed her so hard it felt like they were flaying her themselves. They even dumped in some stinky sweet stuff that smelled like flowers. And afterwards they insisted she dress herself in girls' things, brown woolen stockings and a light linen shift, and over that a light green gown with acorns embroidered all over the bodice in brown thread, and more acorns bordering the hem.
"My great-aunt is a scepter at a mother-house in Old Town,"
Lady Smallwood said, as the women laced the gown up Arya's back.
"I sent my daughter there when the war began. She'll have outgrown these things by the time she returns, no doubt. Are you fond of dancing, child? Maya Karelin's a lovely dancer. She sings beautifully as well. What do you like to do?"
She scuffed a toe amongst the rushes.
"Needlework. Very restful, isn't it?"
"Well," said Arya, "not the way I do it."
"No, I've always found it so. The gods give us each our little gifts and talents, and it's meant for us to use them, my aunt always says. Any act can be a prayer, if done as well as we are able. Isn't that a lovely thought? Remember that the next time you do your needlework. Do you work at it every day?"
"I did till I lost needle. My new one's not as good."
"In times like these, we must make do as best we can." Lady Smallwood fussed at the bodice of the gown. "Now, you look a proper young lady."
"I'm not a lady," Arya wanted to tell her. "I'm a wolf."
"I do not know who you are, child," the woman said, "and it may be that's for the best. Someone important, I fear."
She smoothed down Arya's collar.
"In times like these, it is better to be insignificant. Would that I could keep you here with me. That would not be safe, though. I have walls, but too few men to hold them," she sighed.
Supper was being served in the hall by the time Arya was all washed and combed and dressed. Gendry took one look and laughed so hard that wine came out of his nose, until Harwin gave him a thwack alongside the ear. The meal was plain but filling. Mutton and mushrooms, brown bread, peas pudding, and baked apples with yellow cheese. When the food had been cleared and the servants sent away, Greenbeard lowered his voice to ask if her ladyship had word of the Lightning Lord.
"Word?" she smiled. "They were here, not a fortnight past. Them and a dozen more. Driving sheep. I could scarcely believe my eyes. Thoros gave me three as thanks. You've eaten one tonight."
"Thoros, herding sheep?"
Angai laughed aloud.
I grant you it was an odd sight, but Thoros claimed that as a priest he knew how to tend a flock."
"Aye, and shear them too," chuckled Lem Lemoncloak.
"Someone could make a rare fine song of that." Tom plucked a string on his woodharp.
Lady Smallwood gave him a withering look.
"Someone who doesn't rhyme carry-on with Don Darion, perhaps, or play Ole my sweet lass down in the grass to every milkmaid in the shower and leave two of them with big bellies." "It was, let me drink your beauty," said Tom defensively, "and milkmaids are always glad to hear it, as was a certain high-born lady, I do recall. I play to please."
Her nostrils flared.
"The Riverlands are full of maids you've pleased, all drinking tansy tea. You'd think a man as old as you would know to spill his seed on their bellies. Men will be calling you Tom Seven Sons before much longer."
"As it happens," said Tom, "I passed seven many years ago, and fine boys they are, too, with voices sweet as nightingales."
Plainly he did not care for the subject. "Did his lordship say where they were bound, milady?" asked Harwin.
"Lord Beric never shares his plans, but there's hunger down near Stony Sept and the Threepenny Wood. I should look for him there."
She took a sip of wine.
"You'd best know. I've had less pleasant callers as well. A pack of wolves came howling around my gates, thinking I might have Jaime Lannister in here."
Tom stopped his plucking.
"Then it's true. The Kingslayer is loose again."
Lady Smallwood gave him a scornful look.
I hardly think they'd be hunting him if he was chained up under River Rotten.
What did my lady tell them? Asked Jack Belucky.
Why, that I had Sir Jamie naked in my bed, but I'd left him much too exhausted to come down. One of them had the effrontery to call me a liar. So we saw them off with a few quarrels. I believe they made for Black Bottom Bend.
Arya squirmed restlessly in her seat.
What Northman was it who came looking after the Kingslayer?
Lady Smallwood seemed surprised that she'd spoken.
They did not give their names, child, but they wore black, with a badge of a white sun on the breast.
A white sun on black was the sigil of Lord Carstark, Arya thought. Those were Rubb's men. She wondered if they were still close. If she could give the outlaws a slip and find them, maybe they would take her to her mother at Riverrun.
"Did they say a Lannister came to escape?" Lem asked.
"They did," said Lady Smallwood. "Not that I believe a word of it. They claimed that Lady Catelyn set him free."
That startled Tom so badly he snapped a string.
"Go on with you," he said. "That's madness."
"It's not true," thought Arya. "It couldn't be true."
"I thought the same," said Lady Smallwood.
That was when Harwin remembered Arya. "Such talk is not for your ears, milady."
"No, I want to hear."
The outlaws were adamant.
"Go on with you, skinny squirrel," said Greenbeard. "Be a good little lady and go play in the yard while we talk now."
Arya stalked away angry and would have slammed the door if it hadn't been so heavy. Darkness had settled over Acorn Hall. A few torches burned along the walls, but that was all. The gates of the little castle were closed and barred. She had promised Harwin that she would not try and run away again, she knew, but that was before they started telling lies about her mother.
"Arya,"
Gendry had followed her out,
"Lady Smallwood said there's a smithy. Want to have a look?"
"If you want." She had nothing else to do.
"This Thoros," Gendry said as they walked past the kennels. "Is he the same Thoros who lived in the castle at King's Landing? A red priest, fat, with a shaved head?"
"I think so." Arya had never spoken to Thoros at King's Landing that she could recall, but she knew who he was. He and Jalabar Zo had been the most colourful figures at Robert's court, and Thoros was a great friend of the king as well.
"He won't remember me, but he used to come to our forge."
The Smallwood forge had not been used in some time, though the smith had hung his tools neatly on the wall. Gendry lit a candle and set it on the anvil while he took down a pair of tongs.
"My master always scolded him about his flaming swords. It was no way to treat good steel, he'd say, but this Thoros never used good steel. He just dipped some cheap sword in wildfire and set it alight. It was only an alchemist trick, my master said, but it scared the horses and some of the greener knights."
She screwed up her face, trying to remember if her father had ever talked about Thoros.
"He isn't very priestly, is he?" "No," Gentry admitted. "Master Mott said Thoros could outdrink even King Robert. They were peas in a pod, he told me. Both gluttons and sots."
"You shouldn't call the king a sot. Maybe King Robert had drunk a lot, but he'd been her father's friend."
"I was talking about Thoros." Gendry reached out with the tongs as if to pinch her face, but Arya swatted them away. "He liked feasts and tourneys. That was why King Robert was so fond of him. And this Thoros was brave. When the walls of Pike crashed down, he was the first through the breach. He fought with one of his flaming swords, setting Iron Men afire with every slash."
"I wish I had a flaming sword." Arya could think of a lot of people she'd like to set on fire.
"It's only a trick, I told you. The wildfire ruins the steel. My master sold Thoros a new sword after every tourney. Every time they would have a fight about the price."
Gendry hung the tongs back up and took down the heavy hammer.
"Master Mott said it was time I made my first longsword.
He gave me a sweet piece of steel, and I knew just how I wanted to shape the blade. Only Yurin came and took me away for the night's watch.
"You can still make swords if you want," said Arya. "You can make them for my brother Rob when we get to River Run."
"River Run?"
Gendry put the hammer down and looked at her.
"You look different now, like a proper girl."
"I look like an oak tree with all these stupid acorns."
"Nice, though, a nice oak tree."
He stepped closer and sniffed at her.
"You even smell nice for a change."
"You don't, you stink." Arya shoved him back against the anvil and made to run, but Gendry caught her arm. She stuck a foot between his legs and tripped him, but he yanked her down with him, and they rolled across the floor of the smithy. He was very strong, but she was quicker. Every time he tried to hold her still, she wriggled free and punched him. Gendry only laughed at the blows, which made her mad. He finally caught both her wrists in one hand and started to tickle her with the other. So Arya slammed her knee between his legs and wrenched free. Both of them were covered in dirt, and one sleeve was torn on her stupid acorn dress. "I bet I don't look so nice now," she shouted. Tom was singing when they returned to the hall.
"My feather bed is deep and soft, and there I'll lay you down. I'll dress you all in yellow silk, and on your head a crown. For you shall be my lady love, and I shall be your lord. And I'll always keep you safe and warm, and guard you with my sword."
Harwin took one look at them and burst out laughing. And Angai smiled one of his stupid, freckly smiles and said, "Are we certain this one is a high-born lady?" But Lem Lemoncloak gave Gendry a clout alongside the head. "You want to fight? Fight with me. She's a girl and half your age. You keep your hands off of her. You hear me?"
"I started it," said Arya. "Gendry was just talking."
"Leave the boy, Lem," said Harwin. "Arya did start it, I have no doubt. She was much the same at Winterfell." Tom winked at her as he sang.
"And how she smiled, and how she laughed, the maiden of the tree. She spun away and said to him, 'No feather bed for me. I'll wear a gown of golden leaves and bind my hair with grass. But you can be my forest love, and me your forest lass.'"
"I have no gowns of leaves," said Lady Smallwood, with a small, fond smile. "But Carillon left some other dresses that might serve. Come, child, let's go upstairs and see what we can find."
It was even worse than before. Lady Smallwood insisted that Arya take another bath and cut and comb her hair besides. The dress she put her in this time was sort of lilac-coloured and decorated with little baby pearls. The only good thing about it was that it was so delicate that no one could expect her to ride in it. So the next morning, as they broke their fast, Lady Smallwood gave her breeches, belt and tunic to wear, and a brown doeskin jerkin dotted with iron studs.
"They were my son's things," she said. "He, died when he was 7.
"I'm sorry, my lady." Arya suddenly felt bad for her and ashamed. "I'm sorry I tore the acorn dress, too. It was pretty."
"Yes, child. And so are you. Be brave."
Catelyn. As she slept amidst the rolling grasslands, Catelyn dreamt that Bran was whole again, that Arya and Sansa held hands, that Rickon was still a babe at her breast, Rob, crownless, played with a wooden sword. And when all were safe asleep, she found Ned in her bed, smiling. Sweet it was. Sweet. And gone too soon. Dawn came cruel, a dagger of light. She woke aching and alone and weary, weary of riding, weary of hurting, weary of duty. "I want to weep," she thought. "I want to be comforted. I'm so tired of being strong. I want to be foolish and frightened for once.
just for a small while. That's all. A day. An hour.
Outside her tent, men were stirring. She heard the wicked